Well, tonight we're going to talk about biocommunication, treasure of the mind. Gerald Epling back on Coast to Coast. Fascinating moment on Coast to Coast. So stick with us. We shall be right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Gerald Epling is an expert in memory formation, received his bachelor's degree in computer science, master's of science degree in applied cognitive and neuroscience, and doctor of philosophy degree in neuroscience as well from the University of Texas. Gerald's work includes research into memory formation, consciousness, the phenomenal biocommunication situation. He has 20 years of experience with a wide variety of electronic endeavors, including signal detection and communications. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. It's been about 5 years, Gerald. How are you?
I'm well. It has been a long time. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it sure is. Let's not wait that long next time, okay?
Okay.
What's new with you?
Well, I just got back from a trip to China. I went to a longevity village called Bama and looked into how the plants were growing and how the people were living and took some readings on the magnetic fields in the area.
And I bet you find that plants are almost as live as we are.
They are. They're very lively in that area. If you treat your lawn with herbicides and then try to go back and make it an organic lawn, it takes 2 or 3 years to get to the point where you can get good communication with the plants again. But the plants that I experienced around Bama were very communicative.
It's a little like the work of Cleve Baxter, too, isn't it?
Oh, a lot of my work is based on Cleve. He's the giant. I stand on his shoulders. He wrote the book on that primary perception. And in it, he talks about his first discovery of this phenomenal biocommunication, February 2nd, 1966. Outstanding contributor to our understanding of this science that is so new.
You know, I'll always remember a story he was telling me, Gerald, about two plants that were in this dark room. And, you know, a guy goes in there and rips one out to shreds.
Right.
And they hook up the other plant to electrodes and the guy leaves and he comes back, and the thing is, they're just hitting the numbers. It's just going crazy.
It recognized him. They had other people walk in, and the plant did not alarm on the other people, the ones who had not hurt the paired plant. So, yeah, that was a really interesting study that Cleve did.
It's pretty dramatic how a plant that, I guess it would make people think, those people who are vegetarians think twice the next time they eat a carrot, huh?
Well, everything's alive, apparently.
Yeah.
Carrots, I don't know, maybe the rocks, too. There seems to be some sort of a life force in the universe. But I know the living things, the things we can identify clearly as living, plants, people, microbes, organisms, they all have this electromagnetic field around them.
You've been doing a lot of work into memory and also the bio experience of the mind. What's going on there?
I have. The last time we spoke, you challenged me to look for ways to tune people up.
Yep.
And I thought about that, and I pondered it and realized that I could write apps that would let people change the state of consciousness more easily. So I wrote apps for the BlackBerry Playbook, the BlackBerry Z10, the Amazon Kindle, especially the HD, the one with two speakers. And these apps allow people to hear tones that help them launch into a different state of consciousness, perhaps sleep if they're having trouble getting to sleep. I have a Restful Delta app. And if they want to be creative, there's a Theta Imagination Stimulating app. So I've been doing a lot of work on that score because I wanted to be able to point people to something that they could get their hands on and experience this life. And that's how I came with the name BioExperience. We don't understand much about this communication between plants and people, food, living cells, but we know it happens. We know it's on the quantum level, and we know it's very interesting. So rather than try to overdefine it, I just call it life experience or bioexperience. And I made a website called bioexperience.com, and occasionally I'll post a new app out there or just talk about some things that I found in the scientific literature or some of the things I've discovered in my research.
How do the apps work, Gerald?
Well, the apps play one tone. By example, they may play 100 hertz in the right ear and 102 hertz in the left ear. So the difference is 2 cycles per second, right?
Should be.
Yeah. So then your brain wants to get into the act, so it wants to oscillate certain parts of the brain at 2 cycles per second. And that makes you feel relaxed and sleepy. So that's the basic way that it works.
Gerald, let's talk a little bit about memory. And why is that so important here?
Memory, to me, is anything that remains after the event. So if you have an emotional reaction to something, and then you go on through and you walk away from it, but you still have some emotion remaining, that's memory. There are also the memories that you can have that you seek to form, such as a memory to pass a calculus test. You want to really study that math and get the right things into your brain. So it seems that most of the things we do are built on memory. When you see something, the retina is stimulated, and what you're really working with in your brain is a memory rather than real time. It's delayed by a fraction of a second. So I thought memory would be a great way to get at consciousness.
You talk about how something, to be memorable, you have to look at four specific things, right?
That's right. First, you have to be paying attention. If you're not paying attention, then it's unlikely that you'll form a good memory.
Right over your head.
It just goes right by. And then it has to be a little bit exciting, so you go up a little bit. And then you have to have a good mood, so that you can form the memory. If you're really upset or very agitated, it's difficult to form a memory. It's easier if you're more relaxed. The third thing is it's important to have the event be meaningful. Somebody speaking to you in a language you understand will be more meaningful than somebody speaking to you in a language you don't understand.
Right.
And if you experience something that's similar to something you already know, it's a lot easier to remember. Fourth, you need to have a way to organize this memory into your life, a big overriding structure. Maybe it'll fit in an environment.
Why do some people have a good memory, other people don't?
There are a number of reasons. Some people have nutritional deficits. They can't really get the neurons firing to pay attention. Other people are too overloaded. They have so much going on, they can't choose one thing and sit down and really look at it. In my memory research, I found that if you'll show people letters or words on a screen, and you put them on the screen and then take them off and never really stabilize them on the screen for a period of time, they have a very difficult time remembering that. So you need to get them on the computer screen or in front of the person to have them stable for a certain amount of time. So you have to have that ability to actually focus to be able to have a memory.
Gerald, do some people generally remember the good or the bad about their past?
Oh, now that is an interesting question. If you look at the people who have the best memories out there, I mean, just phenomenal memories, ask them what was happening May 3rd, 1998, and they'll know and they'll be right. Many times they have difficulty with friendships because they remember every slight, every insult.
Uh-huh.
And so it's tough for those guys.
So people generally will what?
Well, a lot of people just generally forget things. Forgetting is an art form, I think. To forget what some people would consider a slight or an insult, that's an important part of living. And I think it's a very helpful part of living. I think people who have really, really good memories sometimes have problems looking beyond things that aren't so pleasant in their life. All of their memories are there with them at will.
You know, I know in my case, you know, I remember some really happy episodes of my childhood. I remember these things.
Yeah.
I don't particularly remember the bad episodes of my childhood. I had a pretty good childhood, great parents. They were just superb people.
Right.
So maybe I didn't have a lot, but I tend to believe or remember the good than the bad. Is that the norm?
That's a personality trait, and that's an excellent personality trait. I think that's pretty much the norm. Most people are more comfortable with that, and I think they naturally gravitate to that. It's a really good indication of a good life.
Yet in some forms of memory formation, you will have some of those people who will remember the horrible things in their life.
You will. Remember, it has to have sort of an excitement to it, to have a memory.
Yes.
Sometimes the worst memories we ever have come with a very large emotional charge.
Some kind of drama?
Some kind of drama. Some kind of terrible, horrific event. And these memories, they're hard to deal with. The best thing that I know for a person to do with this sort of a memory is to rest, take B vitamins, try to be healthy, and then perhaps review the memory from time to time. And if they're still having trouble with it, go for help. Talk to a friend about the memory and try to talk it out. Or even seek a therapist. Talk to a therapist and let that therapist work you through that memory till the emotional charge comes off of it. And then it's much easier to deal with.
Some people, Gerald, when they meet someone, like seconds later, won't remember who the person is in terms of their name. Right. I mean, they say, hey, my name's, Joe Smith. And then, Joe Smith walks away and the person says, what was his name? How come they can't grasp that?
Usually they're preoccupied with something. We can pay attention to about 7 things at any given time. Some people can pay attention to 9. Some people are limited to about 5. But we'll just say it's 7. So if they're preoccupied thinking about something else and that involves 3 or 4 of those things that they can pay attention to, there's just no room in their life to learn a new name.
So they're not even concentrating on that individual.
Yeah, they may not be able to. They may have something that is just so engaging and so engrossing that they can't concentrate on that individual.
Could it be because the individual might, to them, be dull?
It could be, although it's hard to imagine someone looking at other people as dull, but I suppose that...
If that happens, I mean, I see it, I see it all the time where, a group of 4 people will come in and, hi, I'm so-and-so, so-and-so, and, most people won't remember who these people are unless there's a specific reason they need to.
You're right. If you're never going to see them again, then it's hard to be motivated. It doesn't seem meaningful. It's just someone coming through your life and moving on. So in that case, I can see why many people wouldn't remember.
Now, when you talk about biocommunication, exactly what does that mean?
Okay, biocommunication is a very broad field. It includes, and I'm talking about just a small portion in my research, but let me go paint the scenery first.
Sure.
When a plant is threatened, it might put out a chemical messenger, and the other plants would feel this, and then they could respond by changing their chemistry so that whatever bug was coming towards them might be repelled. So that's a chemical messenger biocommunication. And it's understood. We know that these chemical messengers go out, the plant responds, things happen. There are salts that you can give to a plant, and you can read the electrophysiology on the leaf, and you can see how it responds to the salt or the poison or the water or the nutrient. And that's biocommunication, because that's life communicating with life, plant to plant. But then there's this phenomenal biocommunication. That's what really intrigues me, because we don't understand it. We don't know why it happens, but we do have evidence that it happens on the quantum level. We have the electrophysiological recordings showing that those plants are responding to the thoughts of people or to the actions that are used against or for the plants. If you plant a plant in the garden and there's another plant that grew up with that plant, the second plant will give a little response that shows that it's happy that the first plant was planted and watered.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Wait.
That's bizarre.
It is. It's bizarre.
Do plants feel pain?
I've come to conclude that plants have some kind of an emotional system. And this emotional system does respond to things that damage the plant. And eventually the plant will shut down, just like a person. If a person has too much pain, they'll just go numb.
If somehow we could record the sounds of plants or vegetation, and if somebody was cutting the grass, I mean, would you hear like all these little screams?
I think the grass.
No.
I think the grass knows you're tending to it and you're doing something that's good for it. So I think it probably just goes into the sort of a semi-numb state where it kind of relaxes, like, okay, the guy's going to cut the lawn today. Here we go. But you're not digging it up by the roots.
That's amazing. I mean, I guess people just couldn't function if they thought that plants suffered. Or, look at the big push right now not to use monkeys, for example, or rabbits in the medical testing, and pharmaceutical testing, cosmetic testing. They're doing away with that a little bit at a time.
Sure.
Because they don't want the animal to hurt or suffer. cattle, for example, when they take them to slaughter, they're now pressuring slaughterhouses to, you know, do it as humanely as you can.
Right.
In terms of plants, I mean, if, what would people do, you know, if they knew, for example, if you pulled a head of lettuce out of the ground, that it was like decapitating the thing?
No, it is an interesting thing. And the animal research is, it figures into my background too. I've done animal research with rats, studying the hippocampal formation and looking at how various chemicals could affect the brain. And all the time I was thinking, isn't there a better way to do this? Can I use a lower life form? And that's one of the things that led me to plants, because plants are a lower life form than a rat or a mouse or a worm. But back to the response of plants and how agitated they may get, I grew some collard greens in the backyard, and I would monitor them when I ripped off a leaf to eat, and there was no major response. It was like, oh, this is the natural order of things.
Yeah,
fine.
No big deal.
No big deal. But when I purposed in my mind to burn a leaf, that plant responded just like...
It went crazy.
Just like Cleve Baxter saw February 2nd, 1966.
Did you burn the leaf while it was still attached to the plant?
I did.
Ah.
I did. And, you know, I didn't repeat that experiment because it did something to me to see this. And to, oh, wow, it really, I mean, I was surprised. It changed
my
thinking.
Did it bother you?
Yeah, it bothered me. I didn't know for sure whether I could replicate the Baxter experiment or not. And you don't want to hurt things. It was clear to me from the traces that if this was a person, it would be a person in pain. So
I don't think people could function if they thought that way.
No. So don't burn plant leaves. Don't start forest fires.
Well, I mean, if you cut down a tree, is like the tree in severe pain when you do that?
Now, that I don't know. I think if it's the natural order of things from what I've seen so far, from harvesting lettuce. And I
don't think a tree wants to get cut down.
Yeah, you've got a point there. That may not. I don't know. I haven't done a tree study.
That's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
What about, you know, and I know you haven't studied insects, but,
no.
But you know, an ant, for example, I think an extremely intelligent creature. You know, look what they do. They're engineers.
Right.
Do you think if somebody was coming by ready to step on them, squash them, they would know that? They could see danger?
Mm-hmm. There are studies that show, Cleve Baxter did this. He monitored a plant while somebody went and caught a spider. And the plant showed a simultaneous response. It showed the response of the spider, basically, as they caught it. So there is this biocommunication across the species.
I would think that every living thing must have some kind of intelligence behind it.
Oh, yes. I'm with you on that. I totally agree, George.
And, you know, the big difference is, you know, they can't communicate with us. If they could, we might think differently about everything, wouldn't we?
We might. I mean, it's changed my thinking. I feel a lot more confident now when I do a study on water to see if the water is going to be good water or not. I have a lot more confidence that that study with a plant will give me a useful result. Having seen the electrophysiological results of these plants responding to me and to the environment.
Well, I'm convinced, you know, under the Gaia theory, that the planet is alive. It's an organism to itself. What do you think of that?
You know, it's an interesting theory. If you look at oil, it seems like oil is not a one-time commodity on this planet.
No, I think it's part of the planet indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, stay with us, Jerry. We're going to come back, talk a little bit about the mind of murderers and criminals. I want to get your thoughts on that and talk a little bit more about some of these other episodes. Gerald Epley with us, his book, Treasure of the Mind. One of his websites, bioexperience.com. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we call the television program Beyond Belief, and you can watch it, as a matter of fact, 10 days free, where you can look at all the videos that are provided there, too. So take advantage of that. Go to coasttocoastam.com, click hosts at the top, and then click the TV button, and there you go. We'll be back with more with Gerald Epling as we talk about biocommunication on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Gerald Epling. Gerald, let's talk a little bit about the mind of a murderer, a criminal. Some of them just do it at will. They don't have any remorse. What is it about their brains that allow them to do that?
Many times when you look at the brains of these murderers, if you can look at them on an energy scan where you can see the energy in their brain, you'll find that they don't have activation in the parts of the brain that provide executive functions. Executive functions are what we use to make decisions in life, like, will I go to work today, or should I stay home, or will I go to the beach, or should I read this book or watch TV? Should I help the lady across the street? They don't have functionality in many of these regions. Just limiting one small region of the brain can lead a person to make bad decisions about whether something is acceptable or not. One study, a person set up a scenario where there's some white powder on a table in a laboratory environment. Their friend asks them if it's sugar for coffee, and they say, oh, yeah, sure, it's sugar, but they don't really know if it's sugar or white poison.
Oh, my gosh.
But they tell them, go ahead, and it turns out it's not poison. So then the question to the participant in the experiment is that wrong or not? And I think I would say that was wrong to say, go ahead and take it if you...
Yeah.
And you would too. But in the same experiment, they used an electromagnetic pulse to temporarily disable a part of the brain that's used to make that sort of decision. And they saw that people's ability to decide that that was wrong diminished. So now we have these scans of murderers who have large areas of their brain that show up black on the energy scans. There's not a lot of energy going to this decision-making area. And sometimes to the parts of the brain that allow you to have empathy. So they lack empathy and they lack good skills. They just assume murder somebody is not. No remorse because they don't have any sense of what it's like for the other person to be murdered. The key is to how to engage those parts of the brain. Some people do it with drugs. They use selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors for a while, and sometimes they get stuck on those. And sometimes that just makes the person feel better, which is not necessarily what you want to do.
No.
You might want them to feel the remorse. I'm a big proponent of showing people how plants respond to them and starting there. Gardening, if you can start a child with a little garden, I think that is wonderful because they can see the plants kind of droop and then you water them and they stand up. If you can work with a child and instill this sense of how the plant grows and responds to them, that's great. There are emotionally disturbed children who you have to reach out to in different ways to get past their own numbness, to bring them to a point where they can actually sense the world around them, the people around them. But if you look at these scans of these people, usually it's fairly clear that they're lacking good judgment capability and lacking empathy.
And is that pretty similar, do you think, with most of them? They all have that same pattern?
I couldn't say all because it's sort of a new science doing all these brain scans. But a number of them have shown up to show that it is a scientifically defensible theory that people who have this dark area in their brain are more likely to be capable of murder.
Interesting. Now, were they born with that dark area, or was that developed? Maybe their environment, maybe the way they were treated as kids.
You know, it may be the environment. It may be the way they were treated. They may be shut down, and so you have to try to get them to open up and reconnect with life. It may be the way some of them were born.
How do you fix that? Some people claim that you can rehabilitate a prisoner, for example. Is that because something happens to that dark spot and it gets better, it goes away?
I think the dark spot is more like the thing that comes after working with the prisoner. It's just one indicator that the prisoner may be getting better. But the dark spot should go away when the prisoner, when the person gets better who's had this sort of a violent past. To work with them, again, you have to find a way to get them to connect with life, and you have to find something they can care about. Birdman of Alcatraz, he collected birds, and that made a difference in his life. Something along those lines. And you have to be careful, too, because a person can become so attached to a plant that they don't care about people. And that's a strange dilemma, isn't it?
Sure is.
Yeah. I mean, don't step on my flowers. I'll kick you or break your leg. I mean, just a flower, it'll grow back, okay?
We used to have a little old neighbor lady when we were kids. Every time our ball went in on her front lawn, she'd come out and chase us with a broom. She didn't want us stepping on her grass.
Right.
The grass is supposed to be stepped on.
I think so.
Isn't it?
It's lot in life.
Unbelievable.
It is. And, you know, if you can step on it barefoot, I think it's probably better for you.
Well, how do you stimulate that dark spot in the brain, whether it's a murderer or some individual who just is, you know, down on life?
Well, if it's a person who's depressed, it may be that they're not a murderer at all. They're down on life. They don't feel good. They've had a tough time. Maybe they're an older person and their friends start dying one after another and they get to a down spot. For that sort of person, a good thing to do is to try them to get them out and meet with other people. Maybe go to a place where they can sing with other people, get out and walk with other people. Walking is huge. If you can walk for 20 minutes, you start to kick in a lot of neurotransmitters that make you feel pain less and feel better about life. 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week is just the minimum for really keeping good health. If you can walk, you need to do that. There are other exercises that you can do if you can't walk, but walking is just so easy. If you can walk, you should. So you want people engaged. You want them walking enough to get their neurotransmitters into a state that feels good so that they start to remember what feeling good is like. You want to have more good experiences in life than you have as bad. And you have to try to outweigh the bad with the good.
Gerald, would a bump on the head contribute to the loss of empathy, for example?
It could. The use of an electrostimulation to the brain, sort of an electromagnetic pulse to the brain that made people have less understanding of how it might be bad to tell someone to go ahead and have the white powder in their coffee.
Yeah.
Okay, that's just a thing that comes and goes. They could give them this temporary loss of ability to think. Now, a bump on the head could give you a long-term loss. It could give you a long-term problem. And you could have a lot of different things go wrong with a bump on the head.
Lots of people having a difficult time relaxing, sleeping.
I know.
What's happening to them?
Well, in North America and Europe, studies show that lack of sleep or sleep-related problems are the number one neurological problem that people experience. So then you have to look into why they're experiencing that. It could be the economy for a lot of people, being in debt, having stress about your car payment, your home. That's tough. It could be interpersonal relations. One thing that I noticed in Asia when I was in China that was a little different from here, the people seem to have a connection that I don't necessarily see. By example, at a busy intersection, a bicycle rider may pull out, and then a motorcycle rider, and then a bus, and then a van, and then a taxi. And they all go through this intersection without running over anybody or causing a collision. Little gentle beeps are heard, such as, hey, I'm here, I'm pulling behind you, I'm pulling in front of you. A lot of communication going on. It's different. If there's a red light in America, we definitely stop, and we expect other people to stop. But it's as if people are isolated in their cars. It's like they're in their own world. Being in your own world and the isolation is stressful in itself. You have to find a way to reconnect with the environment around you. One of the first apps I wrote was aimed at helping people sleep. It put out a 2 hertz tone as a beat frequency. And one time I did an upgrade that had a little problem with it. It took a long time to load the first time. And I got so many emails from people that were just really stressed. They were saying that they were trying it. It wasn't working. So I quickly fixed the program so the initial load was faster. Once people find something that works to help them rest, they don't want to lose it. But I think lack of sleep is a symptom of a lot of stress that people don't know how to get rid of.
How dangerous is it not to get the sleep?
It can, well, eventually it can cause you serious health problems.
Really?
Yes. It can lead to higher blood pressure, increased heart rate. And if you have elevated blood pressure for a long period of time, that can lead to stroke or heart disease.
What is it about stress that kills, Gerald?
I think it's the stress on the heart. I used to, you know, look at a lot of different things and have some very complicated theories, but I've simplified things as I go through life and I see common variables all pointing to the same vector. It seems like getting your heart beating more than 120 beats per minute is a bad thing. And it seems like things that stress your heart to the point that you may miss a beat, those are bad things. Energy drinks can do that. If a person has too much caffeine, you can get a position where you get a beat before the atrium fills with blood, and so you miss a beat, and then you have some other beats. If you start missing beats like that, this kind of an arrhythmia, it's probably a good thing to cut back on caffeine if you can. And you may even want to consult a physician, although a lot of people have arrhythmias and there's no real problem. But it never hurts to ask a doctor.
You know, when you deal with memory formation, when a child, for example, can do things and learn and get better, is that all part of memory?
It is. Children are so wonderful because they don't have all of these filters in their head. They don't have so much of a questioning about what they're being told. They'll just take it in. I've enjoyed working with some third graders lately, and I recently took a teaching credential in math so I could get into the high school classroom and see what the learning environment was like. And I think the younger the student, the more open they are to hearing what you say, just letting it soak in, and then once they get an item in their mind, they can relate it to something else. Once they get the item related to something else, then the memory starts to form over time in their little minds, and they're sponges.
What about automatic response? Example, you know, in the beginning when you've got your driver's license, first-time driver, everything was deliberate.
Right.
Later on in life, you get in a car, turn it on, go and do your thing. You don't even think about it anymore.
Right.
What is that?
That's called procedural memory. Those are procedures that you have learned over time, and they're in your toolkit of things you can do. And it's wonderful to have procedural memory. I have equations that I can write off of procedural memory because I've done them enough. When I design electronics, I have certain things that I put together, and it's pretty much on autopilot.
It's just there.
It's just there.
It's the same in just about everything. You know, if you do something on a regular basis, whether it's a job or whatever, it becomes somewhat automatic. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a wonderful thing because what it allows you to do is to transcend the job. You can transcend and have a higher experience. While you're putting it together, you can think about what it's going to be used for, who it will help, what the benefit may be, and you can actually have a very uplifting experience in that way.
I mean, here's the example, playing baseball.
Right.
I used to play a lot of it when I was younger. You know, in the beginning when I started, you know, as a little kid, I mean, I could barely hit the ball. Later on, years later, you know, I was pretty darn good.
Great.
What causes, is that memory too? I mean,
yes.
You just have these reflexes, you have this knowing, and, you know, swinging a bat at a ball and you hit the thing, it's got to be part of memory, right?
It is. You've got muscle memory that you've developed. It's below consciousness level. But you start out deliberately to hold the bat in a certain way, to look at the ball and to swing at it. And eventually you build up muscle memory so your muscles know what's expected of them. And these activities come very quickly. This is something that you see with people who have scoliosis. If they find the right treatment, many times the right treatment is to get a script for certain physical therapies where they learn how to do exercises and things to help align the back, to help it become straighter. And then when they gain that straightness, it feels different, but eventually it becomes the new normal. The new normal is good. So they have this time where they have to put a lot of attention into it, and it's kind of like going uphill. It's getting up, and then they get tired, maybe they go down, and then they come back to the new normal, which is a little better than where they were before because they learned a new technique.
That's interesting. It's a fascinating science, isn't it?
Oh, it truly is. I love memory. I am so glad I went to the University of Texas at Dallas and studied cognition and neuroscience there because I learned the basis that I've used to build on to do more and more things each day. And I'm still building on it and having a great time.
You ever get frustrated, Gerald, when you forget something?
Well, sure, and it happens. But I have the advantage I can think, how many things am I trying to do in my mind at one time right now? And that's a good point. Whenever you drive, you should put all the things aside except driving.
I mean, how many people have names in their cell phone of people that, let's say they haven't called in a long, long time, but they have their names in there?
Right.
If you went through your contact list, you might not even know who they are anymore. You forgot.
That's right.
They're in there, and you have no idea who they are. I bet a lot of people have that issue.
I've gotten to the point where I'm looking up the area code and trying to remember what part of the country this person's from. And that helps me, because then I can usually put the name with a face, and then it makes sense. But yes, that's a common problem.
So sometimes, if you're basically out of sight, out of mind, the brain kind of disconnects something, doesn't it?
Well, it gets sort of put on the back burner. There's the frontal area. If you take your hand and you just put it up to your forehead, and you put your hand on your forehead right behind there, that's the frontal area of the brain. It's on the outside, and in the center, because the brain has two halves, there's some cortex right in the middle, too, and that's really important, that prefrontal cortex back there. All of that is busy doing things that help us have a better life every day, but it's limited. There's only so much of it. And it's limited partially because of the way we organize our thoughts. I'm constantly looking for better ways to organize my thoughts, by the way. But the better organized you are, generally, the better you can dig down and find things that you need to have and bring them back into working memory. Working memory is where you find a lot of limits. Long-term memory, it's amazing how much information is in long-term memory. And if you dig, you can pull it up with different people. But it's amazing, George, just how much the brain can hold and the mind can manipulate.
You have puzzles on your website, BioExperience, that helps people.
I do.
Change things, their state of consciousness, things like that.
Right. I found working with high school students, I worked with high school students learning Algebra 1, freshmen. And many times algebra is taught in 7th or 8th grade, but if you're in high school and you're doing Algebra 1, then, you know, you may need a little extra help with math. And I started to wonder why some students were doing better than others, so I just started taking notes. You know, have you done this? Have you done that? What's your life experience like? I didn't ask them that direct question, but that's where I was headed. And, George, the one thing I found in common with every student that had serious problems with algebra, they had never worked a puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle. They'd never done it.
Never?
Never. Not in their entire life. They had never done it. So I thought, well, I can fix that because all these kids have these little iPhones and iPads and things like that.
Sure.
So I started writing puzzles. I wanted it to be simple. So they're seven pieces in a row and five columns. So there's 7 by 5, that's 35. That fits into the 7 ± 2, and you can go 5 deep. So that helps build a number, a complexity into their brain subconsciously that helps them realize they can master that. And I got it to where it was fun to work, but I really wanted to test it on kids that were very demanding. So I went to some third graders. And they said, yeah, that's kind of neat. I like the picture. Then I added a little glow around it. So when they popped it in, it made a glow. And they liked that. And then I made a little happy chime sound. That's when they grabbed the puzzle and ran to their friends and said, you got to see this.
Yeah, it worked. Hey, Gerald, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take some phone calls with you as we talk about memory. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.